All right, thank you. And good morning. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. It is Tuesday, December 15th. I am Louise Devery-Bjorkman and joined on the panel today by Judges Matthew Johnson and Michelle Larkin. The next case on the calendar for oral argument is State of Minnesota versus Roy Henlein. Counsel, I know you're both familiar with our procedures and they are the same even though we are appearing by Zoom today. You will each have 15 minutes for your argument. Counsel for appellant, you will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. It is important that you state your name and identify the party you represent when you begin your argument. And I think the connections look great, but if any time this morning you have difficulty hearing, please raise your hand and let me know. All right, with that, counsel for appellant, you may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning. My name is Jenna Yauk Erickson. I'm an assistant state public defender, and I represent the appellant in this matter, Mr. Roy Henlein. Mr. Henlein has presented three issues for this court's consideration, all of which request reversal of his theft by swindle conviction. This morning, I'd like to begin by discussing issue two raised in appellant's brief. The pertinent statutory language for this issue allows values, quote, within any 6 month period may be aggregated. The state of Minnesota violated this provision and failed to prove Mr. Henlein guilty because it did not prove he obtained over $35,000 of value within any 6 month period. For that reason, Mr. Henlein's conviction must be reversed.
Ms. Yauk Erickson, am I correct that in this section of your brief, you're challenging the district court's ruling on the pretrial order? Is that correct?
We are challenging the sufficiency of the evidence supporting Mr. Henlein's conviction. So value is an element of every theft offense. Here, the state of Minnesota chose to charge a value over $35,000 and got there by using the aggregation provision.
So, I mean, this issue was fully briefed and decided by the district court pretrial as tried. I mean, you know, and I mean, the jury instructions did not incorporate any aspect of this statute, did they?
So there was no jury. This was a trial by stipulated facts.
I'm sorry. Of course. Yeah. But this issue was not tried to the court at the time of the trial, was it?
Well, Your Honor, so it was raised pretrial. Mr. Henlein asserted a number of reasons that the complaint should be dismissed, that the complaint was improper. The district court ruled on those. Then the case proceeded to the stipulated facts and evidence trial. I believe he sort of reasserted some of the same claims in his written closing argument, which he asserted were to ensure they were preserved for appeal. But the district court had sort of already ruled on them, and I don't believe the order really addresses these issues.
So in part one of your brief, you've stated the three elements of the offense, citing Pratt and the jig, I believe. I mean, where does this issue fit within those three elements stated in your brief?
Sure. So every theft offense in Minnesota includes value as an element. In 609.52 subdivision 3, there's a long list of value provisions that indicate the level of the offense and the possible sentence. There's a case cited in my brief, I'm happy to find it for Your Honor, that indicates that value is an element of theft. Here, the value element is $35,000. Again, the only way the state gets there is by aggregating various thefts, various takings, various obtainments of money over time. So if they violated the statute, if they can't do it, they can't get to $35,000. The complaint, you could say the complaint should have been dismissed. Certainly a conviction on an illegal complaint can't stand, but they also failed to prove the value element beyond a reasonable doubt.
But to the extent, Ms. Yauk Erickson, we agree with that this is a continuous offense. This swindling was a continuous offense. Does this $35,000, does it make any difference either with respect to aggregation or the statute of limitations?
Absolutely, Your Honor. So they are two separate and discrete issues. Even if this court determines that theft by swindle is a continuing offense by doing the statutory interpretation called for under issue three, therefore the complaint did not violate the statute of limitations, you still have to address issue two. And that statute, so 609.52 Subdivision 3, Subpart 5 nonetheless says, state of Minnesota, you can only aggregate separate values in a 6-month time period. Nothing about the statute of limitations vitiates that statute. It still applies. The state of Minnesota is incorrect about the object of the permissiveness of this statute. The statute uses the word may, but may says you can aggregate. It's your choice. You don't have to, you can. What it does not make permissive is the phrase within any 6-month period. That time limit is hard and fast, has no exceptions, and is not permissive, is not voluntary. What's concerning about the state of Minnesota's argument on this issue, the state has never offered any reasonable interpretation of the phrase within any 6-month period. In fact, it offers no interpretation of that language. It instead asks this court to ignore it, to say that the state of Minnesota can charge theft by swindle over any time period it chooses, including 7 years, including 1 year, including 50 years. To do so renders the plain meaning invalid and renders language of that statute superfluous, which this court cannot do. It has to interpret and apply the plain meaning of the statute, find the legislature's intent. The legislature wrote in a 6-month limitation. That is the only reasonable interpretation of this statutory language. The state violated it here, thus did not prove Mr. Henlein guilty as charged, and Mr. Henlein's conviction must be reversed. There are numerous other ways the legislature could have written this provision. They could have said within any 7-year period. They could have taken out the time entirely and just said values may be aggregated, allowing aggregation over any time period, but they didn't. They wrote within any 6-month period. And again, the only interpretation that's ever been offered, certainly the only reasonable interpretation of that language, is that they meant 6 months. Again, the state has not offered any other interpretation of that phrase, of within any 6-month period. The state didn't charge a 6-month period, it charged a 7-year period. The statute does not allow them to do so.
Ms. Yauch-Erickson, it seems like the statute of limitations issue might be consequential. And it seems that most of the cases that have been cited to us are relatively generous in their concept of the continuous nature of an offense. I mean, is there any case that's been cited that where there was a statute of limitations and the appellate court held that it was not continuous?
I don't know that there is such a case in Minnesota, Your Honor, and I would agree that the statute of limitations issue is important here. It is an issue of statutory interpretation, just like issue 2. And significantly, theft by swindle has a specific statute of limitation. The legislature wrote one. It's 5 years. Under the 2C test that applies in the state of Minnesota, this court is required to presume that it's a non-continuing offense. So in the cases that have been cited by both parties, that hasn't been true. So in the series of cases, Lawrence, Furnow, and O'Hagan are really helpful here. So those decided that certain species of theft crimes are continuing offenses, but none of those had specific statutes of limitation. The second thing about Lawrence, Furnow, and O'Hagan is, again, we're doing statutory interpretation. We look at the language of the statute. Those statutes include words that signify continuing action. So those words are conceals, retains, and possesses. Those happen continually, day after day after day. You possess something for as long as you possess it, not at a single moment in time. If you possess something for a year, you're doing it on day one, day 365, and every day in between. The theft by swindle statute not only has none of those words, the actus reus of theft by swindle is obtains. Unlike conceals, possesses, and retains, you obtain something at a single moment in time. You obtain it on day one, and on day two, you're no longer obtaining it, you have it. So as a matter of statutory interpretation, again, you have to apply the presumption under 2C that this is a non-continuing offense, and that presumption would have to be overcome. 2C tells us there's only two ways that happens. The explicit language of the statute compels the conclusion, or the nature of the offense is such that the legislature assuredly meant it to be a continuing offense. Neither are true here.
The theft by swindle, I mean, it connotes a scheme or plan or a ploy under which the theft occurs. And I mean, and doesn't that by its nature suggest that it's more than a one day and then it's been completed sort of offense?
No, Your Honor. And I would suggest that if you look at the wealth of theft by swindle cases in the state of Minnesota, a lot of them show, anecdotally, of course, thefts by swindle. The swindle can be really brief, right? Originally, the statute included three-card Monty and rigged card games. Those happen relatively quickly. There's a whole category of swindles in the state of Minnesota that are non-existent services or sort of fake services or non-existent property, right? A gentleman says, hey, would you like to buy some logs? I have some timber. He doesn't. He's lying. He gets the money and that swindle is over. That doesn't take very long. Certainly, we can all imagine swindles that are more lengthy. But again, we're doing statutory interpretation. And although we can envision some swindles that are lengthy, there's nothing about the nature of the offense that necessarily compels the conclusion, overcomes the rebuttable presumption that it's a continuing offense, because it can be quite brief. And in fact, a lot of times is quite brief.
Ms. Yauch-Erickson, I understand how this case might be different from Lawrence. What about Thang, the 1933 case? It seems to have facts that are very similar to this, essentially a trust or perhaps a conservatorship, and the fiduciary took the money, but it was not revealed until after the limitations period had ended and the Supreme Court said it was not time barred. Why should we, isn't that case an easy one to follow just based on the facts and the results?
I would be quite grateful if Your Honor would either provide me a citation or a spelling. I'm not sure I'm aware of that case.
Sure, Thang, T-H-A-N-G, and it was, it appears in respondent's brief, I think, in a footnote. Thang was cited in Toosey, the U.S. Supreme Court case, and I believe it appears
I'm finding it.
Page 22 of the red brief, footnote 7.
So I suppose I would have to go consult that case and determine whether that was theft by swindle.
Understand. What about Danielski? I understand it's a crim sex case, but it was perhaps not a typical case. It was crim sex based on a position of authority and using the authority to coerce. And our court reasoned that those elements, the third and fourth elements, the authority and the coercion, continued on for a period of time until the offense was disclosed. I mean, aren't there analogies here to theft by swindle where it seems to me he obtained money at various points in time by swindling through various means, and those means may have continued all the way until the disclosure?
Well, that's an interesting point, Your Honor. So I am unaware, and then I'll attempt to answer your question, but I am unaware of any Minnesota authority that indicates that you look at the means by which the actus reus is completed to determine whether an offense is continuing or not. So I would agree with Your Honor, obtainment is both brief and happens at a very discreet point in time. The state could have charged each transfer of money that it alleged was a theft as a separate count. It of course didn't. And the state of Minnesota's position is entirely unclear to me in this case when the obtainment occurred. I don't know if it's when he's terminated from being the trustee. I don't know if it's when the last transfer was performed. The idea that it was obtained as a lump sum is simply wrong. Danielski, I would assert, is, we should be cautious about applying it here, because Danielski is sort of a policy driven case, because child sexual abuse is such a heinous crime. And I think that drove part of the court's analysis. And although we can object morally and ethically to what Mr. Henlein did here, I am reluctant to compare it to something as awful as child sex abuse. And again, we look at the language of the statute. That's what drives the statute of limitations issue. So even if there are aspects of this case that continued over time, it's not just this case. that we analyze. In fact, the facts of this case have nothing to do with the statute of limitations issue. It's about the language of the statute. And I would argue that Lawrence, Furneaux, and O'Hagan are more on point as theft crimes than Danielski is. And they looked for very particular words: conceals, retains, possesses, that show an act over time. We don't have any of those in theft by swindle. The only actus reus is obtains. Obtains, like takes, happens at a discrete moment. It happens when possession is exchanged. That would indicate the legislature did not intend this to be a continuing offense.
With respect to your third argument, am I clear you are challenging the pretrial ruling? And if so, then if we were to agree with you, what would be the proper remedy?
Yes, Your Honor. So my understanding is that when a complaint violates the statute of limitations, what this court does is reverse the conviction. I don't know that there is any other remedy to be had.
Well, but what if we have a series of transfers of money, some of which are within the limitations period and some of which are outside the limitations period, then what would be the appropriate remedy?
Right. So it helps me to think about what should the district court have done. So if the complaint sort of partially violated the statute of limitations, I'm not aware of any doctrine or any authority that the district court can sort of splice up the complaint. The appropriate remedy is to dismiss the complaint. And we can analyze, or the district court could analyze, whether it's with prejudice, without prejudice, whether the state can refile, but the state cannot proceed on a complaint that in part violates the statute of limitations. I know of no authority for that.
Thank you.
All right, thank you, counsel. You will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. We'll now hear from respondents, counsel. You may proceed.
Thank you. May it please the court, counsel. Your honors, my name is Brittany Lawan, and I'm an assistant Hennepin County attorney appearing on behalf of the state of Minnesota. Contrary to appellant's claim that he committed no crime, his conduct here amounts to the very essence of what a swindle is, namely taking advantage of his fiduciary position to pilfer more than $180,000 from the trust account of three children who had just lost their mother to cancer. He abused and used his position of trust to hide his actions, to further his deceit via repeated withdrawals of funds for his own personal benefit, and ultimately over 7 years, he drained the account almost in its entirety. He attempted to cover his tracks by creating false statements and committed ongoing efforts to just assuage the victims that nothing was amiss. They should just trust him. This demonstrates the continuing nature of the swindle that was only completed when he was finally removed as trustee and no longer had access to the account. Because his actions were part of a continuing scheme, the conduct did not end until 2016. Thus, it was appropriately charged and is not prohibited by the statute of limitations. Moreover, in light of the creatively timed embezzlement, he plundered the bulk of the money early on in the scam. So the state acted appropriately here in charging a single felony count to accurately capture the egregiousness of his conduct. I'd point the court to Danielski with regard to a defendant's conduct being part of the determination for the continuing nature of the offense. On page 357 of that opinion, the court is quoting Tahash and Lawrence and talks about cases where the defendants prevented the discovery of the offense and says, quote, "The continuing nature of the offense was determined by a defendant's actions in continuing child abandonment of making discovery of stolen property more difficult for the owner by concealing it and by saying nothing about the fact that $1,000 was missing from the estate for 4 years. The last reference there is talking about the State versus Thang case, which I agree with Judge Johnson is on point here. And I should note, I made a mistake in my respondent's brief in that footnote with reference to Toosie. The reference to Thang is in the dissent in Toosie, and I apologize for that. It is not in the majority opinion. It is part of the dissent in Toosie with a footnote discussing embezzlement, which is the Thang case, but it is the dissent, and I apologize for that.
Ms. Lawan, do you contend that theft by swindle is by definition a continuing offense, or are you saying that the unique circumstances here make it so?
Your Honor, the unique circumstances can make it a continuing offense. There are instances where, as Ms. Yoke Erickson said, it can be quick. It can be a simple transaction where someone is duped into purchasing a log or timber that doesn't exist. That can be a non-continuing offense. However, here, the embezzlement was ongoing. The deception was ongoing. It wasn't each and every individual transaction that is immediately known to be theft, because he was entitled to fees. I think the district court discusses this in how you don't know right away what's happening. It's over the course of conduct. It's looking at it in context that displays whether or not this action was theft. And that demonstrates when the swindle takes place. And that's how you know that it's ongoing in this case. Additionally, with regard to the decision to charge the case here with one count, the word may is permissive. And that statute does not require the state to charge only 6-month increments. If it did, it would be worded differently. I by no means am asking this court to ignore or disregard the within 6 months. That's, if anything, language that allows the prosecutor to decide if they're going to aggregate a large number of offenses, often shoplifting, to get to a felony level if you have a serial shoplifter. If you have a serial offender and you don't want to simply charge 10, 20 misdemeanors, you could do it into one and get a felony count rather than several misdemeanors. That is permissive. There's nothing here that says that this state is required to charge in 6-month increments. It's also important to look at where that language is located in the statute. It's located in the misdemeanor sentencing provision. It does refer to the higher provisions as well, but I just would take note of that.
By saying, Ms. Lawan, by the statute, by saying that the state may aggregate, let me go back. It says the value, I'll paraphrase a bit too, the value of money or property received by the defendant in violation of these statutes within any 6-month period may be aggregated. I mean, doesn't that suggest that if different amounts are received within the 6-month period, the prosecutor may choose to aggregate those or not, or choose not to, but by saying the prosecutor may aggregate them within a 6-month period, doesn't that imply the prosecutor may not aggregate offenses that occur during a period that's longer than 6 months?
Respectfully, I disagree, Your Honor. I don't think that it says that they may not. If it were to prohibit such conduct, the statute would need to say that. It allows for the aggregation, but it does not require it, nor does it prohibit not aggregating. If one were to look
But what is the purpose of the 6-month period language then? We could take out the words within any 6-month period, and then I feel like the statute would have the same meaning with or without that language in your mind. Am I incorrect about that?
I don't think that it would change the meaning of the statute because the statute is permissive. There's no requirement here. I think that if anything, the 6-month period that's included is to give guidance as to what the limitation would be to aggregate it in certain instances to try to get to that number. I don't think that it's required to do that though. If the limitation, if it says 6 months, it just means you can't simply charge one count for 1 week. You can't charge, you can if you'd like to, but you don't have to. I think it's just supposed to help in this instance so that if there are thefts, single thefts against different individuals that the state wished to combine, they could do so and it allots for a 6-month period. Here though, it doesn't even apply because of the fact that this is a single course of conduct. There are three victims, they're from the same family, but it's the same trust account. So in essence, it's one victim, the trust account and the trustee beneficiaries. And so this isn't an incident where you have 20 different instances of shoplifting at Kohl's where the prosecutor is trying to get over a misdemeanor threshold. This isn't an incident where you're trying to simply establish a serial check fraud or any of those natures. My reading of the statute is that it's permissive and that it's not requiring the state to limit itself to 6 months. That would also get rid of the statute of limitations in a sense, because it would extremely restrict and narrow the statute in what is prohibited. And that the theft by swindle statute is very broad. It includes language of any other means. It includes language of any artifice, trick, or device. So this is not something where it's supposed to be limited to what happens in 6 months. It would also encourage people to do a really good job of stealing money in 6 months, then wait, go to the next 6 months and start over. And if you are so deceptive that the person doesn't notice the theft, they're out of luck.
What do we do with, there's a statement in Glidden, where the Supreme Court says one of the primary purposes is to provide a limit of 6 months on the aggregating period. Is your argument consistent with that statement?
Your Honor, I recognize that that statement is in Glidden. I think that my argument is consistent in the sense that Glidden is speaking in dicta there. If you look at the language in Glidden, it says it appears that the statute is trying to do this. So it explicitly also the court in Glidden does not decide the issue and sends it back to, because the Court of Appeals went further than when than they should have because the issue was not raised. There's also language in Glidden on page 746 that says, the reality is that it is often in the defendant's best interest for the prosecutor to aggregate all the various takings over a period longer than 6 months into a single felony theft charge. So I think you have to look at both those statements when you're looking at Glidden. And here, the conduct is different. In Glidden, it was each individual act was an act of theft by swindle. It wasn't necessarily a continuing offense in that instance, because this was an instance where each time she filled out the fake return receipt, that itself was illegal in nature. Whereas here, as the district court recognized, there were instances where the theft might not have been discovered right away because it might have been the fees that he was allowed as while acting as trustee. And you had to kind of look at the context and the overlying time to determine the conduct and what the nature of the conduct was. Otherwise, we'd have an instance where he could say, oh, it was just a mistake. This is just bad bookkeeping. I'm just a bad businessman. I'm not very good at keeping track of those things. So that's why you're allowed to look at the whole context of it.
Ms. Lewin, Ms. Yelk-Erickson previously argued that the second issue is that we should frame it as a sufficiency challenge, that the state has, that by not proving that the alleged incidents occurred within a 6 month period, that the state has failed to prove the offense. What's your view of that?
I disagree and believe that the state did prove the amount that was stolen, obviously, based on the stipulated facts.
Well, let's assume for the moment that we disagree with you about the interpretation of this aggregation statute. And so we accept appellant's interpretation of that statute, but then is it appropriate to frame the issue up for review by this court as a sufficiency of the evidence review? Is it appropriate to consider this issue within the context of a sufficiency of the evidence argument?
I think this court would be within the bounds to not treat it as a sufficiency argument because it's coming from a motion to dismiss and it's not directly a challenge of the motion to dismiss. And the district court's order denying the motion to dismiss addresses both the statute of limitation and the aggregation issues, neither of which were raised when the case went to trial. Well, stipulated facts trial.
Well, if we were to agree with appellant's interpretation of the statute, what would the appellate remedy be then?
With regard to the statute of limitations or with regard to the aggregation, Your Honor?
I'm sorry, I'm referring to the second issue, the aggregation statute.
I think that it would be, if the court were to agree that the aggregation required only in a 6 month period here, because it was not charged as such, I think it would be an outright reversal, because I think that that's a matter of an error that would require it to go back. I don't know that perhaps it could be sent back for a new trial, but I think I'd like to say that I think it could go back for a new trial, but I imagine that if that would undercut most of the case because of the fact that here, which I think the district court in its order denying the motion to dismiss notes that the majority of the money was taken early on. And so the periods like 70,000 was in 2009, 70,000 in 2010, and it starts dwindling down in amounts where the last $6 of the account, leaving a dollar left, was taken November 10th after Mr. Henline had been removed as the trustee. He still took or had offered to resign. He took six of the last $7 out. So the amount dwindles and it's going to be harder for our office to prove it. I think reversing and remanding it and letting us to recharge it appropriately would be the result that I would want in that instance, if that makes sense.
I have a question about the first issue raised in appellant's brief, which I'll just summarize by saying that I think the argument is there's no swindle. There may have been a theft, but there was not a theft by swindle. So, and the appellant's brief cites numerous cases where the defendant appellant engaged in a somewhat elaborate scheme. This case seems less elaborate. It seems more straightforward. I'll call it a garden variety case of taking money from somebody. I mean, which of the cases in your brief or in the case law are most similar, perhaps the most simplified version of theft by swindle?
I think State versus Thang would be, Your Honor, especially because that's just an outright embezzlement. Also, if you look, were to look
but
at State
that, but that wasn't charged under the same statute, I don't believe, with the same statutory language, was it?
No, it wasn't. And that was before the modified criminal code was enacted. So that was, I believe, in the 1930, I think it was charged. Also, if this court were to look at State versus Franklin, that was initially charged as a theft by swindle, but then a temporary taking. That case is 692 Northwest 2nd. 82 on pages 85 verse to 86. It's a court of appeals decision from 2005. That's an instance where a mother is charged with gambling away her daughter's money that should have gone to a trust fund and or to a trust account after her father had died. And it was charged and challenged as to whether she was entitled to part of it because it was she was a parent and the child was a minor. But still, that's something where the money that was supposed to go to the child was taken by the trustee in that sense. I think it was $12,000 that was taken to a casino. I also would point to the language in some of the decisions, even if the act itself is not similar. If you were to look at Hodge, the Supreme Court talks about how if a victim's confidence is fraudulently procured by a method which would normally dispel suspicion or caution, the requirements of the statute have been satisfied. Here, Mr. Henline is saying, oh, I have a statement here. Sorry, I didn't get your email. I'm providing you information. That he's acting in a manner that's trying to continue the deception and tell them nothing is amiss, nothing to see here. The money's there. And so that's something that Hodge is helpful with. And I think also in looking at Ruffin, there isn't a precise definition of swindle because it can cover such a range of possibilities. I would argue that appellant's argument that it should only be a trick or only be obtaining it through a three-card Monty or one of those original things, that is limiting the statute. That's much too narrow. This statute is broad. This statute is designed to cover all types of cheaters. I believe that Ruffin says this act has for its purpose the prohibition of an undesirable form of conduct rather than a specific act. That's demonstrative of the legislature's intent that this is about the swindle, not whether it's a simple trick, not whether it's I have timber, but I don't really have timber. It's about an act of embezzlement. It's about protecting people who've been misled. And here the defendant's conduct was by definition misleading these three children and taking the money that was rightfully theirs all along a 7-year period. And it was only discovered and only stopped when he was removed as a trustee. With that, I would ask this court to affirm the district court.
Thank you, counsel. Counsel for appellant, you have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. I think it's notable that when asked by this court to pick out cases most similar to Mr. Henline's conduct, the state of Minnesota cannot find one that's a theft by swindle case. I was able to reconsult Thang during my opponent's argument. It was a grand larceny in the first degree case. It wasn't even charged as theft by swindle. The theft by swindle statute existed at that point. The other case my opponent named is Franklin. Franklin was found not guilty of theft by swindle. We are not asserting that Mr. Henline did not commit a crime, that this conduct was acceptable or good. What we are asserting is that the state of Minnesota chose to charge this case in a specific way. It charged one count of theft by swindle that covered 7 years of time when the statute of limitations is 5. In other words, it made multiple mistakes. They compounded each other. And necessarily, at this point, the evidence is insufficient because of these mistakes.
Now, with respect to your first argument, if theft by swindle is not the appropriate offense, are you willing to identify any other offense in the criminal code that is more appropriate or is the appropriate offense for this conduct?
Theft. Subdivision 2-1, theft, taking. He took their money. There's little doubt about that. And of course, a jury or the parties would have had to sort out which takings, which transfers were legitimate and which weren't, which were criminal. The facts of this case, as I know this court is aware, are incredibly complicated. There were 20 some bank accounts, transfers every which way. There was legitimate money in some of these counts. There were legitimate disbursements to the trust beneficiaries and there were appropriate fees. So you essentially need a forensic accountant to decide what was appropriate money, what was illegal money, how do we charge this, but they didn't even try.
But doesn't the complexity that you're just describing suggest this is more than a series of thefts, that this is part of an overall scheme to take and conceal the takings?
Well, that's not enough. So theft by swindle demands something very specific, that you obtain money by the swindle. And under Pratt, what that means is that the victims gave up possession of the money because of the swindle. That didn't happen here. They asked him to be trustee. There was nothing untoward about it. He wasn't pretending to be a different person. He didn't seek out to become the trustee. He got the life insurance money legitimately. He didn't just take that check and run off. He deposited it. The other interesting thing about the facts here, the state has never alleged, we have no idea, we don't have any theory about at what point in time he did swindleous things and at what point in time he made transfers. We don't know that at the point in time he took the first money, what conduct he had towards the trust beneficiaries. He was doing this in secret. He didn't have to swindle them. He had access to the money. He had lawful access to the money. Again, it's irrelevant at this point whether it's criminal or not criminal. The question is whether it was a theft by swindle, and it wasn't. If he had, for example, each time he made an illegitimate transfer, a transfer that wasn't legitimate fees, if he had contacted them and said, hello, trust beneficiaries, just so you know, I'm going to take $30,000 out of the trust this week, but I'm going to invest it, and then didn't do that, that looks much more like a theft by swindle. The theft by swindle cases are really categorized by affirmative actions. You get the victim to give up their money by swindling them. There is little to none of that conduct in this record.
Well, Michelle Garrickson, I'm sorry, go ahead, Judge Berkman.
Well, I was just saying that, I mean, part of that is a unique circumstance is that this is a fiduciary. So he's not going to be having the direct representations, but he's sort of swindling himself, isn't he?
Well, and again, Your Honor, I'm not here to tell you that what he did was morally, ethically acceptable. I think it was probably tortious. There was some sort of civil remedy to be had here. The question is whether the state satisfied its burden to prove all of the elements of theft by swindle within the proper statutory period and by only charging 6-month increments. They didn't.
As you've noted, I think the previous version of the statute made reference to three-card Monte and some other specific schemes. And then in the mid-60s, I think it was, the statute was amended, renumbered. And so now it says, by swindling, comma, by artifice, trick, device, comma, or any other means. I mean, isn't that phrase, any other means, pretty broad? And doesn't that encompass the facts of this case?
It is broad language, Your Honor, and I would agree with the case law that sort of says we can't have any more specific definition of swindle because there's a lot of them. There's a lot of different kinds. But what you need in order, well, for the state to satisfy its burden to prove every element of theft by swindle beyond a reasonable doubt is obtaining money by swindle. So if you just have a swindle that's unsuccessful, that's not a crime. The victim has got to be compelled, induced to give up his money or property by the swindle. And that's what you don't have here. You don't have that causal connection. There were a lot of things going on. There were maybe some misrepresentations. I don't know that it amounts to a swindle, but even if it did, it's got to be the swindle that causes the victims to relinquish their money, and they didn't. They gave him access to the money early on, and after that, they didn't do anything. This was done in secret. The state could have charged this differently, should have charged this differently, but didn't. For all of these reasons, I would ask this court to reverse Mr. Henline's theft by swindle conviction. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you both for your arguments. The case was well presented. We will take the matter under advisement and issue our decision within the statutory period. That is the last matter scheduled for oral argument today, so we will recess to consider the rest of our calendar. Thank you.